Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome to the very unscripted Newsbusters podcast. We don't have anybody who selects carefully what will be said and who will be allowed to say it, like the so-called CNN town hall. Our Curtis Houck was here in real time making the videos and doing the counts. He calls it another clownish pep rally littered with watered-down softballs. Yes, Curtis, tell us what you really think. It is one of those things where you just the whole concept of this gets annoying, and that is that you're not really allowing people to say what they want to say. And the pattern I was noticing, and was mentioning this to Curtis, he would send me the questions and he would say, what do you think? Do you think this is a question from the right or the left? Or is it a tough question? Is it an easy question? And I said, well, they all seem to be scripted in a particular way, whether the questioner was a Democrat. And of course, it was almost all Democrats. The Republicans they allowed were like 67 minutes in. So if you were tuning in for a Republican question, you'd probably have gone over to baseball or football before they got to a Republican questioner. But the question was always something like, Mr. President, I have a small business and I'm worried about the supply chain and I'm having shortages already. And what is your plan for the supply chain? It would always be somebody be struggling, but the question was always very nicely worded and assumed that he was going to do something nice to fix things. And Mr. President, I'm very concerned about trying to make my ends meet with the rise in gas prices and so on and so forth. What's in your plan to deal with this?
Hey, President Biden.
Hey.
My middle-class family of four lives on a pretty tight budget. My husband and I both work full-time at well-paying jobs, but we still struggle some months to make the ends meet. With rising gas prices and utility prices and grocery prices, we're feeling our discretionary income get squeezed and reduced. What plans does the administration have to help ease this kind of current crunch we're feeling?
There was nothing where either a Republican or a Democrat got to stand up and sound a little like Jim Acosta. Let's imagine some liberal or Democrat getting up and saying, Mr. Biden, you're failing to give Bernie Sanders what he wants. You made a deal with Bernie Sanders to satisfy Bernie Sanders, and you're failing to satisfy Bernie Sanders. Well, maybe they're afraid that when Uncle Joe gets angry, he gets really snippy, and that doesn't make for happy video they can use later.
Why are you so confident he'll change his behavior, Mr. President?
I'm not confident he'll change behavior. What do you do all the time?
So
when did I say I was confident? Let's get it straight. I said what will change their behavior is that the rest of the world reacts to them and it diminishes their standing in the world. I'm not confident of anything. Just stating the fact.
But given his past behavior has not changed, and in that press conference, after sitting down with you for several hours, he denied any involvement in cyber attacks. He downplayed human rights abuses. He even refused to say Alexei Navalny's name. So how does that account to a constructive meeting as President Putin?
You don't understand that. You're in the wrong business.
This really is, using the word town hall is just inaccurate for it. It really is. I mean, it's an encounter with pre-screened questioners and questions. To me, it's a little like, you go bowling with your kids and you put bumpers in the gutters so that the person can't throw a gutter ball. It's bowling for children. That's basically what this is. And then Mr. President's always hitting the pins, one way or another. No gutter balls. We won't allow that to happen.
I bowled a 129.
That's very good. Yeah. Oh, that's very good, Mr. President.
This is like Special Olympics or something.
And not only do you get that with the pre-screened questions and questioners, you certainly got that with Anderson Cooper trying to help Biden finish sentences, or with Biden helping him find, well, there's a port in California and it's Los Angeles and Long Beach, Mr. President. Yes, thank you, Long Beach.
What I've recently done, and people said or doubted we could get it done, I was able to go to the private ports with 40% of all products coming into the United States of America on the West Coast, go through Los Angeles what am I doing here?
Is it Long Beach?
Long Beach, thank you.
And I think we understand that if they were questioning a Republican, they'd probably let him bumble a little longer. But in this case, you know, Anderson Cooper seems to be there to sort of, again, make sure that the bowling ball bounces back into the middle of the lane.
It was like Special Olympics.
These are still better than nothing. This is still putting Biden on the record saying things. What you got afterwards was, to some degree, the liberals would try to say, see, look at how energetic he was. Look at how many facts he had as his command. The idea that you're saying that he's not mentally sharp was totally disproven by this. And then the conservative side of Twitter was like, see, he bumbled, he babbled, he wasn't making any sense. He was crunching up his fists. He's clearly going insane or senile or something.
What am I doing here?
I just like looking at this more as a potential news event. But what CNN's doing here on some level is actually decreasing the newsiness of it by making it so soft and sculpted. It's like a makeup session. So that's unfortunate. They didn't give him any tough questions that really were going to rattle him. And they didn't really ask any tough questions about what the other thing we're going to discuss today. Where is the culture headed? And why does the left, the people who say that they are for compassion and kindness and diversity and inclusion, are so intolerant of opposing points of view? Why does that happen? We'll be discussing that next. And we're back on the Newsbusters podcast with our guest this week, Christian Toto. You may read him on Newsbusters on Saturdays, but we're usually selecting something excellent from his website, HollywoodInToto.com, which is about entertainment in general, not just media bias issues or Hollywood bias issues, but sort of entertainment in general. And Christian also has a podcast called Right on Hollywood. So I guess the first question, Christian, is there a double meaning in that? Does it mean the right's take on Hollywood? It doesn't sound like you're saying, it's not an affirmation like you're right on Hollywood.
No, not quite. It is critical at times of Hollywood, and also it celebrates the industry when it does something right or makes a great movie or TV show. But it's an extension of my website. And actually, I had a podcast that I was doing on my own for a while. But then a pandemic hit and I had two young boys who were kind of roaming around the house. I thought, I just can't record anymore. So wanted to reboot it. And now I'm with justthenews.com. So I'm on their podcast platform.
Yes, I've enjoyed it already. And we will get to that. I have been obsessing for the last couple of days about the Dave Chappelle controversy. And you on your site have written a series of things on that. I just isolated the media coverage because the story I saw on NBC Nightly News was so bad. And of course, it was only like 100 seconds long. But I started complaining to Mrs. Graham about it. And she said, well, what's wrong with it? And I proceeded to lecture for about 3 minutes about what was wrong with it. And I said, I think I have a column here. and then the PBS NewsHour was also bad. So I guess what I would address to you and what my concern was is it does seem like there's only one point of view that the media will discuss or tolerate. They don't seem to want to let there be a debate. And more interesting, they don't seem to want to engage with what Chappelle actually said. They don't have a habit of citing what was actually said.
Yeah, that's a great pattern that you see over and again. You know, we saw it maybe more dramatically with the Gina Carano situation when she was canceled by Disney. And really Hollywood in general, you always get suspicious when you don't hear direct evidence of what the problem is. That's sort of the first red flag. But yeah, listen, when you watch the media coverage of the Dave Chappelle situation, it is abundantly clear where the media stands. They're not siding with a black comedian who just so happens to be the most popular, most talented stand-up of his time. That's not what they're after. They've got their own narrative. And, on my side, I covered recently how the Associated Press and also Variety misconstrued the protest. There was a protest. People were walking out of the Netflix headquarters, and a few people were on Dave Chappelle's side, and they held up signs saying, like, we like jokes, we like Dave, which is actually kind of funny. And the protesters that were against Dave were angry. They ripped out their sign. They were yelling terrible things. But those two august outlets framed it the complete opposite way, even though we saw it all on video. And that's, I think, must be shocking to you, that we're living in an age where you could actually see stuff on video, watch it unroll before your eyes, and then look at the media and it's a different narrative. That fascinates me and makes me sick.
Well, I mean, here's AP, who has its own fact-checking operation that should really be fact-checking their own captions, right? It was a it was a caption that was ridiculous, that it actually got everything backwards. It was sort of like they said that the Chappelle fan was being profane or whatever, when the video shows the exact opposite.
I mean, that's a fascinating just point in media coverage history, where we can actually see the truth before our own eyes, and reporters say, oh, no, this is the truth. And then sometimes when they are embarrassed on Twitter or social media in general, they do correct the record. I think the AP went back and tweaked that caption. But often they don't, and the record stands. If you read the newspaper or wherever you get your news, you're thinking, oh, this is the version of reality, when it's often the opposite.
So what was in the Variety article? Because I noted in my column, NBC used this so-called reporter from Variety, who really seemed more like a publicity advocate for the transgender employees, sort of saying they're going to have to give in to these demands. We have a list of demands. Or excuse me, they have a list of demands. I mean, he didn't make that mistake, but he could have, because it seemed like he was there to represent this small, tiny faction of Netflix employees.
Yeah, well, Variety also misconstrued the protests and who were the aggressors and who were the people just being quiet. But yeah, it's so obvious they have a side. It's just very clear. And, also what's interesting, and no news to you, is how the media will extend a story like this. When they've got a story, they like the narrative, they want to promote it, they will find a thousand different angles to keep it alive.
Yeah.
But if it's a pullout of Afghanistan, which leads to complete tragedy and death and destruction and geopolitical nightmares, that's the story they can't wait to stop telling. And so you see that accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, we call these things a news hook. And obviously at Newsbusters, a lot of times what we're doing is, certainly in an era like this when the Democrats are in charge, of sort of listing all the news hooks that are provided either by the conservative media or sometimes by the establishment print media. They did a story and watch everybody ignore it. I mean, for us, one of our tactics is always to say, here's a story that Bret Baier did on Special Report on Fox News, which is sort of the newsiest program in the evening or late afternoon on Fox News, and say, well, the other networks didn't do this. I think the point that got me about this protest is that it was basically identified that there were dozens of protesters. And my ancient hobby horse of a complaint is, the March for Life here in DC will attract 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 people. And that's all dismissed as just some sort of publicity shtick. And when you get 12 people protesting Dave Chappelle, that's national news.
Yeah, it's part of the game they play. And I'm sure, I didn't examine all the photographs of it, but I'm sure if you looked at a news site, they would crop the photos to make it look as boisterous and well-attended as possible, rather than sort of a longer shot that shows that not that many people were here. But it also is important, because you know, Chappelle has millions of fans. People love the work he does. And, you know, he's a liberal guy. He's not a, it's not like conservatives are rallying for a fellow conservative. But, you know, why should this small group of people have say and sway over what Dave Chappelle is able to do? And you know, when I first saw the video and heard about this protest and the kerfuffle there, I thought, okay, well, the media can't cover this element because it makes the side that they're rooting for look bad. But I forgot they just make stuff up too. So they did cover it, but then several major outlets just lied.
Yeah, I think that there is a, this is why, as you suggest, the idea of there being any balance, you would start with having a balance from one, actually tell us what's offensive in the special. Let Chappelle speak for himself. Or let people who are fans of Chappelle, or just for people who think comedians should have free speech, why don't you give them a few minutes in a story and that they can't do that? I thought that this interview on the PBS NewsHour with the trans woman advocate, where the one challenging question Amna Nawaz gave her was, well, they say comedy's provocative. That's kind of the point. And she just says, you know, there's nothing, you know, nothing worthwhile in mocking transgenders. And I think what's interesting about what Chappelle did, at least in the part that we've written about here, was it wasn't so much mocking transgenders in terms of making jokes at their expense. It was him actually making statements or arguments where he said things that they can't stand to hear, which is, gender is a fact. Every one of us came out of a woman. And they hate that. And this, Imara Jones very much runs this usual argument they make, which is somehow you're either erasing them, you're dehumanizing them, you're setting them up to be murdered because you're not acknowledging their quote-unquote truth, I guess. But, you know, how do, I just want to, I mean, this is a rhetorical question, I guess. If the news media says it's about the facts and it's about being a moderator of our politics, why aren't they trying to moderate this instead of just lecturing us?
Yeah, they have no interest in being fair and balanced anymore. You know, the fact that MSNBC exists doesn't rankle me. There's an audience for it. It has an overt bias, and they are not—they're transparent about that element of it. And it doesn't bother me. It is what it is. And you know, we could poke fun at many of the broadcasts and what the anchors happen to say. But you know, I want to see a Washington Post that's being straight down the middle. That's what their job should be. That should be job number one. And they're not, and they don't care. What I found fascinating the last couple of years, it's again frustrating, is that you'll see things happening on Twitter where a journalist will come out and maybe promote his or her story. And then you look at the replies, and the replies will say, oh no, this is wrong. Here's why it's wrong. And do they not read it at all? Do they not read the replies? Do they just tune it out? Or are they so sort of arrogant? They go, you know what? No, I'm the journalist. You're just the gal on Twitter. Like that intrigues me because, you know, if I get notes from my editor, if I'm filing a freelance story, I listen, I take it in. Sometimes I disagree, but I want to get better, and I want to get the story right. I mean, that should be paramount. And it's just so interesting that social media exists for people to respond to journalists and to correct them and often it's done in a very helpful way. Like, hey, this is wrong, you know. They don't care. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think the nature of Twitter is, yes, you certainly could hear people replying to you and assess what they're having to say to you and say, is that true, is that false? I think everything I do, you have to write, when you're writing about liberals and you want to say, now, when the liberal reads this, is it going to read to them like you understand what they're trying to say, or are you cartooning what they're saying? Mm-hmm. Because that happens a lot. Sometimes you can say, well, we have sort of an energetic spin on the way you said that, and that's sort of the nature of the business. But I have to think that liberals read their comments, certainly their blue check comments. Doesn't mean they're going to change anything. But I think that they do look at that. But my guess is, Christian, is that liberal journalists are much more interested in the opinions of other liberal journalists, other liberal actors in the political culture. They're much more concerned about being accused of not being positive enough about the Democrats or not helping the Democrats succeed in this difficult time. I think they're more concerned about criticism from that angle than they're ever going to be concerned about conservative criticism of what they're doing. And
yeah, it's a great point. I mean, when the New York Times puts out a story or even a headline that the left deems inappropriate or too mean to their side, they will kick and fight. And then often it gets changed, and it gets changed quickly. So that's where they do react. They do see the criticisms, and they do proceed accordingly. That's, I mean, yeah, it's a good point.
Now, we've been discussing sort of the trend in general here under Biden and how everything changes. And the late night scene has really changed because now we're in a situation where you'd think the conservative comedian would have more fun because the Democrats are in power. So we have Greg Gutfeld, who not only has an audience where you could expect to say, well, what we're hoping that the Gutfeld show does is get a better rating than Shannon Bream, and her ratings were fine. And then we expect that there, you know, Gutfeld can beat Brian Williams and Don Lemon in the time slot. Well, it's gone well beyond that now, where it's basically he's doing better than all the other shows in late night, except sometimes for Colbert. But somehow I think they don't think of that show as fitting the late night comedy thing. You got into this with an article some guys did where they sort of wanted to suggest that conservative comedy couldn't really even be classified as comedy. I'm trying. You were like, what do they mean? I mean, that's so then you had them on. But I mean, it is one of those things where can't you watch it and either decide it's funny or it's not funny?
Yeah, well, listen, the liberals own the comedy landscape, more or less. I mean, obviously, there are divisions within it and individual comics who are doing their own thing, but they're very protective of it. And so if they see the kind of a breach in the wall, they're going to kind of fight back. And I think that's what you're seeing sometimes. And it's sad to see. And it's also, you know, it's really embarrassing that if you're the Late Show with Stephen Colbert, that you care more about, oh, Trump is announcing a new social media platform, as opposed to, well, the Biden administration has left, you know, hundreds of people behind in Afghanistan. They're still there. We don't know their fate. Or, you know, the deficit's going to balloon because of X, Y, and Z. I mean, these are real world problems. And to see the late night show hosts contort themselves to kind of hit the usual targets, it's kind of sad. And I, you know, I'm sure they will always have a hardcore base of fans, the Colbert fans who know what to expect and want nothing less. But you've got to think that maybe independent viewers are thinking, boy, you're ignoring the president. You've been doing it for 9 months. You're going to keep doing it. I love you, Stephen Colbert, but are you going to talk truth to power at some point, or is this just a game? And I think that's part of the reason why Gutfeld is rising so dramatically.
Yeah, exactly. Because Jimmy Kimmel was explicit. If you like Trump, I don't want you watching my show. I mean, he literally said that out loud. They are narrow casting. I mean, it's a larger audience, but they're narrow casting. And yes, you can go in. I did this with our SnapStream system. You can search the closed captioning, which isn't perfect. But you go into Colbert and you type in the word Biden. And there are shows where there's no zero mentions.
Yeah.
Or he had Charlamagne the God on this week. And Charlamagne the God was basically saying the Democrats are all a bunch of cowards. And then Colbert ends up sort of trying to mildly defend Biden from the idea that the Democrats are all worthless. But there on Colbert's show, you know, you get this irony, which is the liberals say we need to uphold democratic norms. Well, what is Charlemagne the God's agenda? Well, we need to nuke the filibuster and pack the Supreme Court.
Four simple things the Biden administration could do to protect democracy. Number one, you got to protect voting rights, right? You just simply got to. Number two, you have to protect pack the Supreme Court, right? Number three, you have to end the filibuster so you can govern, right? And number four, you have to make an example out of the people who attempted a coup of this country on January 6th.
I think they may do that.
And that's the audience that Colbert and Kimmel are going after. So, I don't know why anybody would watch these shows unless that is the political camp you belong to.
I agree that makes a certain level of sense. But if you look at the landscape, they're all left of center. They're either center left or aggressively left. So the fact that it took Fox News to put a late night alternative for the other half of the country, which you would think would be a pretty sizable audience you'd want to chase down, is really amazing. But they have no interest. And, you know, the fact that Gutfeld is doing so well in any sort of capitalistic system, you think, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm Netflix. I'm going to go find a right of center comedian and give him or her a similar gig and see if I can kind of ride that wave. That won't happen. They're not interested in that. They would rather leave that money on the table. It's so amazing to watch.
Yeah, well, this is where it comes down to the end game, which is most of these corporations are liberal corporations, and that would be to them the ultimate sellout, is to actually say, I mean, we all said this to each other when Rush Limbaugh was in his dominant phase, and Rush Limbaugh had a TV show for a while, and the network television, the syndicators, they'd syndicate it out on a lot of these networks. A lot of these local stations would put it on at like 2 o'clock in the morning. Obviously, there was an audience for that. And yeah, Colbert's proving there's an audience for that, or Gutfeld's proving there's an audience for that. And of course, I guess he probably trained on it with Red Eye, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was a real kind of no rules, no regulations, just doing what I want, a real kind of experimental way for him to get his feet wet in television. And that's exactly what he did. So, you know, he's got sort of that backing behind him. He's already got a fan base. He's written several bestsellers. So, I mean, he was a wise choice to kind of front this kind of show. But how could you be a studio executive on any level and say, gosh, every show is left of center. We could make a fortune if we just kind of buck that trend. Just one show. And they wouldn't do it.
Well, my wife watches the Jimmy Fallon show, because if he's going to make fun of Biden or if it's going to make fun of Trump, a lot of times it's really not political. It's like making fun of his hair or something he said. That to me seems to be the least political, and it seems a little bit more focused on getting a giggle at late in the night. And so that would seem like the alternative. But yes, Fallon is losing to Colbert. So, but I mean, that's... Well,
quick point about Jimmy Fallon. I agree with what you said. He's a more neutral guy. His presentation's more about yucks and laughs and little video shtick. But when he tousled Donald Trump's hair, the media turned on him so aggressively.
Yeah.
And he spent the last years of the Trump administration is eviscerating Trump in a way that was Colbert-esque. But I think that his audience realizes it's not authentic. It's not the real deal. I mean, for better or worse, Stephen Colbert is a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, and he believes what he says. So if I want that, I'd rather go to Colbert than go to Fallon, who's faking it.
Well, I think in Fallon, it's for him to get really vicious is sort of off character, because I think the character of that show is sort of happy-go-lucky, smiley. It doesn't fit him, but you're right that this is how liberals don't understand where we use the term Trump derangement, and I don't use it much, but I think that's a good example of it, is just mussing his hair as somehow a war crime. And Fallon got very hurt by it. He just couldn't understand it. But so one of the things you were talking, or the article you were looking at, where they were talking about conservative comedy, this was the sentence that made me laugh.
Yeah.
There are also intellectual trends that make it possible for Greg Gutfeld to spend two decades sneaking up in the Colberts of the world. Fact check, he's been on what, 6 months?
Yeah, I mean, he's been a presence on Fox for a while.
Yes.
But yeah, it's not exactly the strongest argument in the situation, for sure.
But you and then the other thing was you isolated this whole concept of punching up and punching down. And this is the other line that I thought was funny. Comedy theorists tend to diminish or at least distinguish right-wing humor from what they deem to be more authentic liberal humor. And then he says, philosopher Umberto Eco, for example, demotes joking that fails to critique power structures to the status of mere carnival.
Well, we've got carnival across the late night landscape then. You have comedians who are unwilling to critique the president of the United States, most powerful person in the world. So what is that's carnival?
Right.
By their own definition.
Right. Well, this is, and I think this is where we can actually sort of dissect the argument of the left, which is somehow when they talk about critiquing power structures, they're really not talking about who's elected. They're talking about it's a capitalist white capitalist power structure,
right, right.
And until the entire power structure is dismantled, you're not really being revolutionary. I think they have a very exaggerated sense of what critiquing power structures is, and I think that's the other thing where we go back for a second to the transgender lobby. It's that whole idea of we're marginalized, and you're not, but. Who are they trying to marginalize? They're trying to marginalize Chappelle. They're trying to marginalize conservatives. Their whole game is to get people canceled, and they're using that marginalized status to be the bully.
And also the talk of punching down. Saturday Night Live recently did a skit mocking the parents who are attending school board meetings, and I believe Stephen Colbert did something similar. These are just parents who are worried about their children and what they're learning in school. These are not powerful people. These are not people who wield, you know, they're not CEOs, the heads, captains of industry. These are mom and dads with concerns. That is an absolute definition of punching down, and they don't care. And, you know, for years, these different comedians would punch down at Trump fans. And often this was, you know, blue collar people. Maybe they were struggling to find a job or maybe paying the bills. Again, it's the absolute punching down. All these new comedy rules are just feints. They're dodges for them to do what they want to do. That's it.
I think with like a lot of things, it depends. Parents are good if the parents are insisting that we all need to wear a mask. Those mm-hmm. sorts of parents are the good parents. People who are pushing the anti-Trump agenda, those are the good parents. If you're actually concerned about porn in the library or critical race theory in the classroom, that's something different. If you're a parent that's pushing climate change, well, then you're a good parent. I mean, that's Greta Thunberg's parents. Those are the best parents. I mean, and that to me, it seems to me like they're not always punching up or down. They're just always punching right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, correct me if I'm wrong, wouldn't late night TV hosts be on the front lines of the Dave Chappelle situation and saying, you know what, I understand people may be upset by his jokes, but he's a comedian, he's my friend, he's one of the best in the business, we need to be able to tell the jokes we want to tell. And also lost in the whole Dave Chappelle shuffle is how he speaks so movingly of a friendship he has with a trans person, and how he's not trying to hate on that community. I mean, it isn't like he's just spit-firing all these nasty jokes. There's context, there's humanity, there are layers and layers to the work he does, which is one of the reasons why he's so good at what he does.
Well, I think this is what people are missing out if they're going to see the 100-second story from NBC or this very stilted interview on the PBS NewsHour, is there's just no discussion of what he's actually saying. And yes, people were describing this. I haven't seen the special, but people here at the office have been saying, yes, he goes on this whole talk about how he had a transgender comic that he was mentoring, and the other transgenders got so mad at this person because they were helping out or somehow making Chappelle normal or something, and she committed suicide. Now, how does that not make your context when you're evaluating whether or not this show is transphobic or whatever? It just seems like they don't really want to engage in what it is that Chappelle's saying.
Yeah. I mean, people on the left at this point in our culture are not well-equipped to debate. They're not used to debating people. They'd rather shut the other voices down than have those kind of healthy conversations. We see it all the time. We see it on college campuses. It, you know, it's the, you're racist, you're sexist, you're a homophobe, you know, the deplorable line. And that is meant to shut up the conversation, not to spark it, not to excite it, not to make it lively. Because I think if we have those real conversations, then I think both sides may come away changed in a positive way.
Well, this is... I would like to say this as conservatives, and especially as conservatives who spend their entire working day watching liberal news outlets, we are engaged in looking at liberal reportage and liberal argumentation, and we're spending a lot more time inside liberal brains than these people running so-called news networks spend any time evaluating conservative thought. They're so closed-minded, I'm going to guess you could argue that they would scoff at the term conservative thought. So, I mean, that is something that we would at least suspect. I mean, it is rare now. You get some of this on Fox, but it's very rare now that you get a conservative and a liberal or a Republican and a Democrat in the same segment on a news channel or in a Nightline. I mean, that is sort of an antiquated thing. So, yes, conversations of that type aren't going to be allowed. And they're not even going to be allowed in stilted town halls where CNN screens out all the adversarial opinion out of questions so that Biden doesn't get upset. Final thought. Unfortunately, we had an accidental shooting on a movie set, and the accidental shooter was Alec Baldwin. And a cinematographer died. And the director, the bullet apparently, or casing or whatever it was, went through this woman and into the director. And that has to feel terrible if you're Alec Baldwin. Although, and maybe it's mean of me, but I went and digged out what Alec Baldwin wrote on the Huffington Post in 2006 when it was Dick Cheney's accidental shooting of his friend Harry Whittington. No one died, but there was Alec Baldwin basically saying Cheney was a terrorist, et cetera, et cetera. And you just say, gosh, you know, I hope and I think we will. I think we're all going to give Alec Baldwin more generosity than he certainly gave Dick Cheney.
Yeah, this is a horrifying story. It's one that we really need much, much more information on to really figure out what happened, who could be at blame, how it could be prevented. It's one of the more shocking stories I've ever heard come out of Hollywood, certainly at a single incident. I mean, guns are used constantly across Hollywood. You can talk about that as much as you want, for sure, about the cultural impact.
Yep. But
there must be protocols and measures. It beggars belief that this happened. And I don't, you know, and I agree, you know, I've been standing down on social media about Alec Baldwin. He doesn't seem to be a very pleasant person. I think he's shown a toxic side to him on many, many occasions. And I've written about how,
yes,
if cancel culture was authentic, he would have been canceled a long time ago for all the things he's done. But, you know, at the end of the day, he killed someone accidentally, and he's going to live with that the rest of his life. And it's just an awful situation. This, all I can say is it never, ever should have happened. These people should still be alive and making a movie. We need a lot more information to figure out what happened.
Yeah, that's absolutely where we are right now. But I think, yes, what we do know is that, I guess it's a lesson to all of us, and that is, liberals say they're the compassionate ones, that they're the ones that have kindness. But I think here's obviously a prime example of someone who usually didn't lead with kindness. And I think that my complaint at this point is simply going to be, I think Dave Chappelle's going to get more negative press this year than Alec Baldwin's going to get.
Yeah, yeah. The Chappelle story is not over. And again, I think Netflix will not take his special down. But I think it's almost besides the point, because if you're a comedian right now and every comedian on the planet is not Dave Chappelle, they are less powerful, they are less funny, they have less iconic status than Dave Chappelle, and you're writing a joke that's challenging or that goes into some difficult arenas, you're going to have to think twice, maybe think three times. Do I even want to tell this joke? Is it really worth it to my career to go through what Dave Chappelle just went through? Because I'm not going to have his protection or his money or his clout or his fame. I just could get just hammered for telling the wrong joke.
This is exactly what Barry Weiss was trying to explain to Brian Stelter on CNN the other day. And that is, she literally put in her list of things that the world's gone mad. You can't say we're born boys and girls. I mean, and so that is something that the hold of the gay and lesbian alliance against defamation cops on not just the entertainment industry, but the news industry as well, is something that goes unquestioned, because that is, it's a third rail even to criticize them. And they have script approval a lot of times. I mean, we've gone from the Hays Code to the Gays Code. But I would like to thank you for coming on, Christian Toto of the Right on Hollywood podcast, hollywoodandtoto.com, and I believe author of a forthcoming book, if you could explain that for a second.
Yeah, it's called Virtue Bums, How Hollywood Got Woke and Lost Its Soul. It's coming in January. You can pre-order it right now. And it's the book that I couldn't, it was the easiest thing for me to write because I had so much in my mind and there were so many examples. And it's the book that I, once I finished it, I thought, wouldn't it be great if cancel culture and the woke mob, if it was receding by the time my book came out, I'd like, I would have less book sales, but I'd be super happy with that. But that's not where we are right now. So when the book does come out in January, it's going to be a hot topic still. And I wish that were not the case, but it is. And the book really does explain why it matters, why it's about power more than making society a better place, and how it's really just ruined Hollywood, you know, an industry that I adore. It's you know, I fashioned my career to become a film critic and a media reporter because I love Hollywood. I love movies and I love TV shows. And I'm just saddened by what this has all become.
Well, we have a lot of those here at Newsbusters, and they're fans of what you do, and you'll have to come by again when the book's out and you're doing your tour. Come on the Newsbusters podcast. That's what we have for today, so come to Newsbusters once, twice, 24 times a day. Thanks for listening.